available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Welcome to Outlook. My name's Peter Walters, and this edition is being recorded on the 18th of February 2026. Coming up in this week's programme, Mary Poppins. Long live Mary Poppins. She goes on and on. Coventry landmarks we've loved and lost. Well, there have been a few of those in recent times. And the bright lights of Liverpool. All that, plus our usual features of sport and postbag, after the news, read by Jeremy and Elaine.
Outlook News.
Council tax bills in Coventry will rise less than expected, with the local authority set to sign off a 3.95% increase. Labour-run Coventry City Council had been budgeting for the maximum rise of 4.99%, but said it had been able to reduce that amount after receiving better than expected funding from central government. It's the first time in more than 15 years the council will not ask for the maximum rise, and will mean about £95 extra a year for a Band D property, rather than the £120 initially forecast. "I'm really conscious that people are having a hard time out there," said Councillor Richard Brown, Labour's Cabinet Member for Finance at Coventry City Council. "So anything we can do to help them is something that we take very, very seriously." When it was pointed out that the rise was still above inflation, which currently sits at 3.4%, Mr Brown said £1.6 billion had been stripped away from the council since 2010. "We got a better deal for this year, but it's going to take us some time to get back to where we need to be. The increase will mean the council loses £1.8 million from its budget, but it insists it will still be able to invest sufficiently, citing an additional £7.7 million due to be put into services. It said it was looking at a one-off £2 million investment to improve roads, footpaths and street cleaning, and tackle fly-tipping. Extra staff are also due to be recruited to help deal with antisocial behaviour. Significant cost increases are expected in some departments in the next financial year, with adult social care expenditure expected to rise by £4.3 million. On top of that, the council predicts increases to the national living wage will add a further £1.8 million in adult social care costs. Inflation is predicted to add £6 million to the council's spending, and operational pressures such as tree surveys and pest control issues are predicted to add £2.9 million to this year's outgoings. The budget is due to be signed off at a meeting of the full council on February the 24th.
Family hubs in Coventry will be given £6 million of government funding over the next 3 years. Coventry City Council said the money will also support its Start for Life Healthy Babies programme. The services hosted in the family hubs are free of charge to users and include computer access, data banks, travel schemes and warm spaces. The new funding will come from the Department for Education and the Department for Health and Social Care, in a provisional 3-year allocation of £6,117,000. The council is set to publish its Best Start local plan before next month to show how the funding will be used. Councillor Pat Seaman, the Cabinet Member for Children and Young People, said it was good news for the city. Speaking at Tuesday's Cabinet meeting, she said, "Since April 2022, Coventry has been one of 75 local authorities championing the Start for Life programme. Over that period of time, we've received £6 million in grants. Coventry is also one of 13 trailblazer sites across England, and as such, has received national recognition and contributed to programme evaluations. We've been doing a great job. A council report about the Community Hubs programme said that the government had committed to making sure that every child had the best start in life.
A borough's entire collection of 257 artworks is due to go on display together for the first time in decades. A special exhibition entitled Unveiled is due to open at Rugby Art Gallery and Museum on the 21st of February and will run until the 6th of June. It spans a period of 80 years of British art, including post-war scenes and contemporary works. Art bosses say it is a rare opportunity to see all the works together in one place and to find out how the collection has grown and changed over the years. The Rugby Art Collection was founded in 1946, excuse me, as a way of making art accessible to everyone. It has become a nationally significant collection and includes works by L.S. Lowry, Lucian Freud, Barbara Hepworth, Bridget Riley, Paul Arrigo, Lubaina Himid, Maggie Hamling and Gillian Waring. It's a celebration of creativity, curiosity and community, showing how a public collection can remain alive and relevant today, said Maggie O'Rourke, the council portfolio holder for partnerships and well-being. The Rugby Collection is owned by Rugby Borough Council on behalf of its residents, and I hope that many of our residents will want to visit and view the collection for the first time. A new book will also launch alongside the exhibition, marking 80 years of the collection. It covers the history of the collection, some of its most exciting acquisitions, and the people who have helped shape it. The new exhibition will be free of charge to visit.
A 13-year-old boy has raised more than £2,500 online after his friend's home was destroyed by fire. Lucas and his mum Sharon were spurred into action following a blaze at Fallow Hill Flats in Leamington Spa. One of the little girls had literally run out with not even a pair of shoes on her feet. It was just heartbreaking, said Sharon, adding that she was extremely proud of her son's actions. They've been left without a house, no clothes, they've got nothing, and it's just quite sad, Lucas said. Warwick District Council has confirmed four families were affected by the fire that broke out about 4:30 p.m. last Tuesday. Three of the families need to be rehoused, while the fourth will be able to return as their property is habitable. Lucas started fundraising just hours after the fire, while his mum posted on Facebook asking for donations of clothes and other items for those affected. Local pub, The Fusilier, has been taking donations, Sharon said, with items also going to those in neighbouring flats. Today I must have delivered 30 to 40 bags and boxes of clothes and teddies to the family, she added. Leamington has pulled out all the stops to help this family. Lucas added, even if it's £1 or £5, anything really helps, to be honest. In a statement, the leader of Warwick District Council said he was shocked by the news of the fire and passed on his condolences to the family who lost their pet. Councillor Ian Davison said the authorities' housing officers would be available at the scene on Sydenham Drive, so residents could advise them of any damage and the wider impact could be assessed.
Parents are being urged to make sure their children are vaccinated before the return to school after the half-term break, as measles cases rise across the West Midlands. According to the UK Health Security Agency, data shows 25 laboratory-confirmed cases in the region so far this year, compared to 76 for the whole of 2025. In England as a whole, there have been 96 confirmed cases this year. The measles, mumps and rubella vaccination, MMR, would help protect children against serious illness. The UK recently lost its measles elimination status, the World Health Organization announced. Elimination status means there is no sustained transmission. The largely expected World Health Organization move was based on the spread of cases in 2024. From October 23 to February 24, 71% of England's measles cases came from the West Midlands. Measles can lead to complications such as ear and chest infections, fits, diarrhea and dehydration in younger children. On rare occasions, it can lead to serious problems, including meningitis, blindness and hearing loss. In a very small number of cases, measles can be fatal. Dr. Ash Banerjee from NHS England in the Midlands said, "Half term offers a natural pause for families, which is a good opportunity to check whether vaccinations are up to date. With the new measles data, we want parents and carers to feel supported seeking advice about anything they're unsure of, including the new MMRV vaccine, which extends protection to include measles, mumps, rubella and chickenpox or varicella. It's never too late to get up to date on your MMR or MMRV or any other childhood vaccines for the best protection."
A para-dressage rider says competing internationally at one of the world's biggest equestrian events was like a dream come true. Sarah Bates, 55, from Ulster in Warwickshire, will be riding her horse Tango at the CHI Al Shakab competition in Doha, Qatar. She started as a para-athlete after being diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 2012. With the first event to take place this coming Thursday, Sarah says she's on cloud nine. A rider from a very early age, she said the first symptoms of multiple sclerosis began with numbness in her legs. "I tried to ignore it," she added, "just ploughed on and kept ploughing on. It took 5 years for me to admit there was something wrong, and that's when I started down the para-dressage route. And so far, it's been a successful route, with Bates currently ranked 13th in the world in her classification. But reaching the level of international competition has not been easy," she explained. "I train every day," she added. "My horses have to be trained, they have to get used to how I ride, and they had to get used to me having an occasional spasm through the leg or through the hand or through the body," she said. "And they had to just keep going and catch me if I wobble to the side. They are very good. They do look after me." The pair will compete in a team event before taking part in the Grand Prix individual test and a freestyle competition where they will perform to music from the film Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. "It's so exciting. I still can't believe it's real," she said.
The fastest man in the UK this year, and he's not even going to the Olympics. That was the line belted out by the commentator as Coventry-born Joel Fernan stunned onlookers by running the 100 metres in under 10 seconds, breaking one of the most revered barriers in sport. Frustratingly, the performance came just after the cut-off date to qualify for Team GB at Rio 2016. But a decade on, the 37-year-old is at his third Winter Olympics, but his first for Jamaica's bobsleigh team, for whom he came out of retirement last year. He remembers that day in 2016 as one that changed his life. "I don't know if I ever believed that I could do something like that," he told BBC local radio. "It was surreal for a long time, because I wasn't one of British superstar sprinters. But there I was, running sub-10 seconds, number one in the country, and I remember thinking, well, anything can happen." Only four British men have ever run faster on UK soil than his time of 9.96 seconds to win the UK Athletics Championships in Bedford that day. Running fast was just one piece of the jigsaw for Fernan, as he was trying to make ends meet, juggling work and bobsleigh training. "I've done all sorts of jobs. At one point I was a pizza delivery man," he recalled. "I would run in the Diamond League athletic meetings in the daytime. In the evening, I was off out delivering my local pizzas, just anything that needed to be done." Athletics was Fernan's first sporting passion, but his bobsleigh career has been unique. He competed for Great Britain, Switzerland and Jamaica over a period of 15 years. His bronze medal from the 2014 Winter Olympics was only awarded 5 years later because of retrospective doping bans on original medalists. The sport was initially suggested to him by his coach, partly to help support his family. "I was pretty broke and some trials came up," Fernan explained. "It was a tough transition. There is a lot of lifting. You are a mechanic, and there are a lot of long hours and time spent out in freezing cold conditions. If I didn't hold out on those rough days, I would have never known what was coming in the future."
Sky Blues memorabilia is being donated to Coventry schools under a new community initiative. Coventry City Football Club has started donating unused match day programmes to primary schools to inspire young readers, celebrate the club's history and strengthen links between the Sky Blues and local families. Schools will receive bundles of over 50 official Coventry City PUSB, that's Play Up Sky Blues, match day programmes from recent seasons, for teachers to use in reading corners, classroom activities and creative projects, or as a fun take-home item for pupils. Mark Hornby, Head of External Relations at Coventry City, said, "We're pleased to launch this initiative for primary schools in Coventry, making use of surplus programmes from past seasons in a brilliant way. These programmes are full of exciting content that can spark inspiration and encourage a love of reading and of Coventry City. We hope local school pupils enjoy them and feel even more connected to their local club."
He's the patron saint of love, and last Saturday millions of people around the world recognised him, indirectly, as cards and gifts were exchanged in celebration of St Valentine's Day. And part of him can be found, it is believed, locked inside a church in Coventry. A shard of bone said to be from the finger of St Valentine, an early Christian martyr, killed by the Roman Emperor Claudius Gothicus in 270 CE, is held at St John the Baptist Church in Fleet Street. But the question remains, how did the finger bone of a Catholic saint, who died in Italy, and whose bones were held in the catacombs of the Vatican, end up in Coventry? The hunt for answers hits an early stumbling block, as any record that could give a complete explanation is likely to have been lost, either in a fire in the 19th century or during the flood at the church a century later. Father Dexter Bracey is the priest in charge at St John the Baptist and the man responsible for taking care of the artefact. It's in a small metal box, and it fits very easily in the palm of my hand, so it's not a massive item. It's tied with ribbon, sealed with a wax seal on the back, which just holds the relic secure. At some point, it's been sealed and stamped to say, "This is a true relic." It is kept inside a reliquary, a golden ornament that would be paraded and shown to the faithful, hoping to be blessed by the saint. Where Coventry comes in is the mystery. What is known is that in the 19th century, St. Valentine's bones were moved out of the catacombs at the Vatican, where he had been buried, and relocated to Ireland. We suspect, but aren't certain, that this portion of his body came here from Dublin. Certainly one of the previous rectors of this church was Irish, Father Bracy said. Despite questions over how it ended up in the West Midlands, the church celebrates with it every Valentine's Day. We get it out round about February the 14th. That's a day when there's quite a bit of interest, and couples do like to come and receive a blessing with the relic, Father Bracy said.
A university student who has topped world rankings in darts has admitted he was not always good at the sport, and he only started throwing the arrows regularly through pure boredom during the COVID lockdown. Jensen Walker, aged 19, was named number one in the World Darts Federation, or WDF, rankings last week. That came after he received call-ups with the Professional Darts Corporation, or PDC, and beat world champion Luke Littler three times. The accountancy student, who is on Coventry University's sports scholarship scheme, said despite his skill with the arrows, he wasn't a natural when he first started playing. The teenager, who first began playing in youth tournaments after the COVID pandemic, qualified for the WDF World Championships in 2025, where he reached the semi-finals. At Christmas, we would always watch the World Championships on TV, and we get the dartboard out of the loft and have a play, Walker said. One year, it stayed up after Christmas, and then the COVID pandemic hit, so through pure boredom, I started chucking, and it spiralled from there. About a year on, I started to realise I was decent at darts, and when we came out of the first wave of lockdowns, I entered a youth tournament. I was a steady player, and as I hadn't played the game properly before, I didn't feel any pressure. Walker's competition wins include victory in the recent Romanian Open Classic and reaching the semi-finals of the WDF World Championships. In his career so far, Walker, from Exhall, north of Coventry, has also beaten the current PDC World Champion Luke Littler, who has lifted back-to-back World Championship titles in his teens. Walker said, "Luke and I started at a very similar time. We've competed for the England team together and have had numerous battles. He's winning 5-3 currently, and I'll take that at the moment." Alongside his desire to go as far as possible in the sport, Walker said he was still prioritising his degree. "It felt the right time to start my studies alongside my darts," he said. "The finances that were up for grabs last year in the sport meant I couldn't risk not putting all my effort into that, so I delayed starting my studies in September and began in January. I'm ready for this now, and it feels right."
An exhibition marking the life and career of Coventry-born singer, songwriter and actress Hazel O'Connor opened last weekend. The artist, famous for 1980s hits Eighth Day and Will You, has had a career stretching over five decades and produced more than 20 albums. She was born in Coventry, and the Being Hazel exhibition at the City's Music Museum will remain open until the end of the year, featuring rare memorabilia and live musical performances. O'Connor was forced to take a step back from the spotlight after a bleed on the brain in 2022. She has spent the following years slowly recovering. A fundraising page was set up in 2025 to raise money towards her care, and in an update in December, organisers said funds were being used to modify her home and pay for a team of carers. The 70-year-old got her own star on Coventry's Walk of Fame in 2010 and performed during the city's City of Culture Festival. Hazel made a name for herself in the 1980 film Breaking Glass as a young singer-songwriter. Artists included Pink, Lady Gaga, and Kylie Minogue, and have credited her as influencing their careers. Visitors to the exhibition will be able to watch the film Breaking Glass on a big screen and hear performances from saxophonist Claire Hurst and pianist Sarah Fisher. Both spent time touring with Hazel, and Hurst, who first met her in the early 1980s, said they had had so much fun together. She said they became friends after meeting at a cocktail event and described Hazel as a very determined person. If she wants to do something, she will. Claire said being Hazel was a lovely exhibition and it meant a lot to see it happen. She's such an amazing songwriter that probably people haven't even heard half of her work, she said. We were hard pushed to decide which ones to do.
A rallying cry has gone out to motorsports fans to get behind a council policy which supports the restoration and protection of Coventry Stadium in Brandon. Rugby Borough Council's new local plan, currently out to public consultation, having gained council approval, includes a policy endorsing restoration of the stadium for speedway, stock car racing and other motorsports. The policy would also protect the site, the former home of the Coventry Bees speedway racing team, from future redevelopment. The Save Coventry Speedway and Stocks, or SCS, campaign group is calling on supporters to back the policy by responding to the consultation. A spokesman said Rugby Borough Council voting in favour of the local plan was a very significant milestone in the effort to restore the stadium, and added it's another huge boost to the campaign to return the site to its rightful motorsports use. The spokesperson went on to say that last year an amazing 1,530 people submitted a response supporting a section of the draft local plan relating to the restoration and reopening of the stadium. Everyone who previously submitted a response will have received details of the new six-week consultation. It's important to stress that this is a new stage of the process, another critical moment in the campaign. Every expression of support is really important, whether you were one of the original respondents or are able to offer support for the first time now. Stadium owners Brandon Estates first proposed demolishing the stadium to build homes on the site in 2014, with the venue closing in 2016. Rugby Borough Council's planning committee refused a revised application in 2022, with a subsequent appeal against the decision rejected by the planning inspectorate in 2024. The company has drawn up revised proposals for up to 115 new homes alongside a fully restored speedway track. Last year, a consortium group backed by SCS revealed plans to buy the stadium and restore it for racing. The SCS spokesperson said further updates on the consortium's bid would be provided in due course.
In a heartwarming Valentine's Day story, a shop owner from Coventry has chosen to spread the love in a different way, with lasagna. Rebecca Harrington, who runs Purdy's Pet Shop, recently cooked for a family as part of Lasagna Love, a global non-profit movement that connects volunteers with people in need of a home-cooked meal. After seeing a Facebook advert, signing up online, and watching training videos, she was matched with a single parent with six children. Ms. Harrington said it was a lovely feeling when she dropped her homemade lasagna and garlic bread off on the family's doorstep. She plans to cook lasagna twice a month and has her next delivery already scheduled. I love cooking. I've got ADHD and it relaxes me. I thought I could actually help somebody out, she said. I lost my father last year, unfortunately, and I was caring for my mum as well, who's got dementia, but I'm fortunate that I've managed to get a living carer to help. so it's given me a bit more time. And sometimes I cook the lasagna at my mother's, and the carers get involved as well. Lasagna Love was founded at the start of the pandemic by Rhiannon Menn, a mother in San Diego, who began cooking meals for her neighbours. What started as a small act of kindness grew into a global movement, operating in the United States, Canada, the UK and Australia. It has more than 80,000 volunteers and delivers an average of 3,500 lasagnas each week, with more than 530,000 meals sent to date. Families can sign up to receive a lasagna without answering questions, and volunteers coordinate contactless deliveries to meet dietary needs. Rebecca explained, "You might be feeling low in your mental health, struggling after surgery, just anything. Go online, request a lasagna, and you'll get matched within a week or so."
Outlook News.
Thanks to our readers, Jeremy and Elaine. Before we move on, one or two things to say. First of all, the lighting up times this week from 5:24 p.m. to 7:17 a.m. So that's getting longer. Some listeners might remember Colin Perrott, who used to be involved with the Wireless for the Blind scheme quite a few years ago now. His son Kevin has been in touch with us to say that he passed away in late November last year, and Kevin said, "Thank you for all your help in the past. My father had a good life and is sorely missed." So if anybody remembers him, that was Colin Perrott. Right, now for news from the Vision Hub, and Hugh is not sitting here for a change. Instead we have Chris Norman and Claire. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We can
Hello.
Talk like you if you want.
We could try. We could,
you know. I hope he's not going to listen to this broadcast. Hello, everybody. We've just come back from Charter House. It was absolutely freezing. Whatever the date is today, it's freezing. It's really cold. But they're wanting to do an audio tour for us. They've got fancy headphones where you can hear the lady's voice, but also they've got sounds of various things, including monk jack deer, which sound weirdly like foxes. What else was there?
There was the ducks.
I love the ducks. Yeah, the ducks. And then at the end, she'd got really random sounds. There was one of a slug eating a mushroom. Yeah. That's right. And
very cool.
Yeah, it sounded like someone snapping celery. It was weird.
It was very odd.
Yeah, hold tight for that. We don't know when that will be yet, but April sometime when it's less freezingly cold.
Yeah, and I'm hoping to organise a trip to Coombe Abbey and do a guided walk. So, again, just I'll keep you updated on that. Yeah. Hopefully we can get some nice spring nature kind of trips in the bag.
Yeah, it'd be nice.
We can all kind of sit outside and drink tea and be happy, and it's not cold.
Yeah, or
muddy.
Yes.
Well, that too.
Yeah, it's kind of muddy. So, in the other direction, for everyone, don't forget the exercise class is no more. So we might bring it back in the summer, maybe do a couple of sessions up at the Memorial Park, but it won't be running on Wednesdays anymore. So that's off. Now Claire's going to talk about this next bit because although I've been in touch with the people, I've forgotten what it's called, when it is, and everything. So can you tell us about the?
So at the Central Library in town on the 26th of March there is a ghost story recital, and it's POC from a company called Weeping Bank. And it starts at 7:15. The tickets are, what, £3.50,
£3.25. They've sent us a special link to get a discount. So the tickets are £3.25 each. So we may or may not run this as a trip. So if people could let us know if you're interested. I mean, I'm interested. I listened to one of their shorts. They've got a YouTube account, so I went on there this morning and listened to one called The Gast. And yeah, it's old-fashioned storytelling so much as it's just one bloke with a ticking clock in the background and various sound effects reading a narrative, but very, very engaging. So it's going to be really good. I really look forward to it.
It does actually sound different.
Yeah, it like, really is.
Cool. So, yeah, let's see who wants to go.
Yeah.
Well, there we have it.
I think that's everything we've got to talk about. So, yeah, thanks for listening. Yeah, thanks for having us all.
Thank you for you too. Thank for coming
you.
In.
Oh, you're welcome.
No worries.
Here's Sarah with this week's sport.
Well, hello there, lovely, lovely listeners, and welcome to sport. I was thinking, actually, when Dave was talking about Postbag, sport and talking to you guys out there has really got me through the pain and frustration of this hip. So thank you all for allowing me into your homes. Now, football. Well, us followers of the City had to wait till Monday for a match. We had to listen to all the other results coming in, and yet again it was a top of the table clash, our third of the season. But this time, I'm afraid, Coventry had slipped to second in the league, overtaken by Middlesbrough, who'd beaten Sheffield United, whilst we could only draw to Oxford United. So it was with a bit of trepidation that I sat down to listen to the match. I decided again I wouldn't risk the fate by watching it on the telly. So instead of CWR, I actually listened to it on TalkSport because I thought I'd enjoy a bit of neutral commentary. Well, neutral. I have to say they couldn't stop raving about Coventry's performance in the first half. And I'm delighted to say, early on, I think it was after about 10 minutes, we scored a goal, or should I say, Hadji Wright scored a goal from a lovely pass from Jack Ridoni. And that was how it ended at half-time, 1-0. But I'm afraid Middlesbrough were like greyhounds out of the trap and bats out of hell in the second half, and totally dominated until, totally against the run of play, Mr. Wright scored again. Coventry 2, Middlesbrough 0. But then they got one back, 2-1. Unfortunately for Middlesbrough, they gave away a penalty when one of their players handled the ball. And guess who stepped up to score his hat-trick? Hadji Wright. And that, my lovely, lovely listeners, is how it finished. Coventry 3, Middlesbrough 1. The one thing I will say is that TalkSport commentators couldn't stop raving about Carl Rushforth, our goalie. And our next match, which I believe is on Saturday, is against West Bromwich Albion. But most importantly, we're top of the league. So what happened locally on Saturday? Well, Coventry Rugby Boys took on Richmond at Butts Park Arena, or BPA as it's now called to its friends. Mm-hmm. Well, this time it was a bit different because they actually trailed at half time but came back stormingly in the second half to come out with a 48-21 victory. So they not only got the point for winning the match, but they got the bonus point for scoring at least 4 tries. And we denied Richmond the bonus point. All looking good. Meanwhile, in the international rugby, the Six Nations continues. So playing at home, Ireland beat Italy quite narrowly, actually, not by the old Ireland thumping margin. Also at home, Scotland beat England just, and so take the Calcutta Cup. So then on Sunday, Wales entertained France, but I'm afraid the run of home wins stopped there, as the French Cock Sportif certainly left the Welsh Dragon in tears on the pitch with a thumping win. In warmer climes, India and Sri Lanka, the Cricket World T20 World Cup continues. Now, it comes to something when one of the lead articles on the BBC website is by the England captain saying, "We ain't going to do very well in this tournament." Well, no, England, unless you buck yourselves up, you are not. Having very narrowly squeaked a victory over Nepal, we were thumped by the West Indies and had what Harry Brooks describes as a nervy finish against the might of Scotland. So, meanwhile, the Winter Olympics in colder climes of Italy, Milano and Cortina continues. Well, I left you last week with saying we weren't doing very well, and I'm afraid the run of misfortune continued. Our curlers, the all-men team and the all-women's team, Kate, fell to some early defeats. Certainly the women's team not doing very well. And Charlotte Brooks, who'd been much vaunted to win the snowboard cross, crashed out. So what could the tea tray deliver? You know, what's called the skeleton. Well, bring on Matt Weston. You won us a gold medal. Matt scored the fastest run in all four of the separate runs and took our first medal of the Winter Games. And just to make it even easier, well, it was a gold. So that meant that since the start of the Games, we have now, in 1924, we have now won 13 medals. It was the first gold medal taken by an individual man since Robin Cousins back in, I believe it was 1980. And any man since Christopher Dean. You know, him of Orville and Queen, as I call them, Torville and Dean. But then we were back to the usual disappointment. Particularly want to mention Niall Tracy, our speed skater. He was the only person sent to Milano to take part in the speed skating. So that must have been quite a lonely experience. He took part in three events, the 3,000 metres, the 1,500 and the 500, which is a real dash and crash. But unfortunately, he crashed out of each one of those. Though he did make it to the final in the 1,500. He actually went into the final as the fastest, with the fastest time. So Saturday, all in all, I was thinking, don't really like this Winter Olympics, getting bored. So by Sunday, I couldn't be bothered to watch it. However, I was listening to the football when they said, oh, Charlotte Banks and Hugh Nightingale have made it into the final in the mixed pairs snowboard cross. So I thought, oh, well, there's only four people get to the final, so we stand an outside chance of a medal. But fourth isn't bad. Well, Hugh went first, and he got an incredible second place, handing over to Charlotte, who did a superb leap towards the end into the first place and crossed the medal first, the line first. We got yet another gold, and this is our first ever gold on snow. amazing. Then things got even more crazy because a few hours later, we won another gold medal. This time, Matt Weston, partnered by Tabby Stoker, who was very lucky to partner him, I have to say, took gold in the mixed pairs skeleton. We're back on that tea tray again. This is the first time ever that Great Britain has won three gold medals in one Winter Olympics. As I said earlier, particularly brilliant as we've only ever won 12 since 1924. At this point, the BBC got a new nickname for Matt Weston, Weston Super Matt, which I thought was brilliant. I've just checked with my smart speaker, won't say her name because she's listening, and our next match is apparently Saturday. It's away, but it's a 12:30 kickoff. For those of you who, like me, will be listening to it on the radio. And on that point, lovely, lovely listeners, I will love you all and leave you and speak to you next week, when I fear I may be bringing the news of more defeats at the Winter Olympic Games. But who knows? Bye!
Many thanks to Sarah for the sport. Here's Dave Monks with Postbag.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello, welcome to your postbag. Hope you're okay. About 2 weeks ago, Graham Whale talked about the prospect of a fourth rubbish bin and the confusion that could cause to visually impaired people, which Mary Hart replies to.
Hi, this is Mary Hart. Now, I'm with Graham in his dismay about our fourth rubbish bin. Because our poor streets are so cluttered these days. They used to be so beautiful, but now they're all such a mess with rubbish bins and cars everywhere. But by the same token, I do agree that we ought to keep the papers separately. Because how it is these days, the paper must get absolutely ruined by all the other stuff that gets chucked in with it, from all the bean tins and the glassware with all the sauces and things, because I don't suppose everybody cleans them out. But with the papers, I've always thought we ought to keep them separate. If you look in the archives of the County Evening Telegraph, you'll see there a letter from me way back when, mainly 60s or 70s, it was such a long time ago, I actually suggested that they keep papers separate from all our usual dustbin rubbish. It's so far back, I guess they were still metal dustbins with rattly lids. But ultimately, something has to be done to save our planet. So I'm still all for keeping papers separately. How to do it, I don't know. Because another bin, it's just going to make it so much more of a mess. Our beautiful old streets that I used to love walking around as a girl, just looking at the gardens and all the lovely frontages. Now all the gardens too have been knocked down because people need to park their cars. Oh, modern life, eh? We just have to put up with it. Bye now.
Thank you so much, Mary, for that clear report, both in speech and recording quality. Presumably you phoned in on 024-76-717-522 and press 5 for Coventry Talking Newspaper. So it can sound good, the sound quality. It's an important subject, and it's great to hear you responding to Graham Whale's concerns about the bins. Keep them coming in. And as far as people getting rid of their front gardens is concerned, American author Bill Bryson, living in Britain, author of Notes from a Small Island, wrote at one time that it was a citizen's duty at one time to help prettify the neighbourhood by having displays of flowers in their gardens. But now they have become little car parks. One of the listeners sent a message in once. She was Scottish, and she said, "Only in Britain do people keep their cheap lawnmower in a locked garage, but park their expensive cars costing thousands of pounds on the driveway." Can he make any sense of it? Elizabeth has recorded this report on a film she saw about a couple who were a Neil Diamond tribute act, celebrating his music. Their inspiring lives were touched with tragedy. Elizabeth tells you about the man himself, Neil Diamond.
This week we saw a film, Song Sung Blue, which was a biopic about Neil Diamond. Apparently he was born in Brooklyn in 1941. His dad had a haberdashery shop. He is Jewish, as is Bob Dylan. He went to Erasmus High School in Brooklyn, and Barbara Streisand attended at the same time in the 1950s. They sang in the same choir, but they were not friends. He wrote Hear Them Bells when he was only 16 years old, for his girlfriend at the time, Jane. He had two daughters with his first wife, Marcia, in New York. He wrote Cherry Cherry and Solitary Man first. Then he had two sons with his second wife, but he was with her for 25 years. He wrote Sweet Caroline apparently in less than an hour, and he dedicated it to President Kennedy's daughter, Caroline. It was his biggest selling song. He wrote Crackling Rosie in 1971, also Hot August Night at the same time. Although he considers I Am I Said to be his best work. He was paid $50 a week at Tin Pan Alley. He has sold over 130 million records for over 50 years. He wrote I'm a Believer for the Monkees, and then he decided to do it for himself too. He was paid $3.5 million for his part in The Jazz Singer. In actual fact, more than the actors. In September 2009, he wrote Pretty Amazing Grace. He sang a duet too with Shirley Bassey. His little daughter, Marjorie, came in whilst he was making one song, What a Beautiful Noise, and so he wrote it for her. He also appeared at Glastonbury in 2008.
Thank you, Elizabeth. In the words of the way people join in with Sweet Caroline, that was so good, so good, so good. Julia, who is hard of hearing, says she likes your reports, which is nice to be appreciated and a mark of how clearly you speak. Elizabeth researches a subject really well, and what she has to say is so interesting. She's a people person, and when she's at the Monday Club, she goes around chatting to people round the table. I'm not asking you to go into great detail when you send the message in, just to say hello to your fellow listeners and let them know they're not alone. Have you any thoughts on the 50th birthday of Outlook on the 16th of September this year? Any ideas on how we should celebrate it? Do you have any memories of the early editions? How did you come to start listening to Outlook? following the news that Coventry City Centre has been given a Purple Award for safety, etc., how safe do you feel when you're going there? Graham Whale responds to an invitation from Hugh for men to have a test for prostate cancer, which is something that Chris McCausland mentioned in his comedy show. Well, it is something I plan to sign up for, so I hope you do if you're a man. Here's Graham.
You mentioned the prostate screening program and the need to get checked out for prostate cancer. The problem is, if you go to your GP and request a PSA, he may want to do, or she may want to do, another type of test, which isn't quite so pleasant. Actually, it's not as bad as it sounds. But I've gone through the process. I was referred to the urologist. I had a biopsy, a MRI scan, and they couldn't find anything. After 5 years of having enough of me, they discharged me with a proviso that I take a PSA test every 6 months for the GP. And if it goes up anywhere near 15, they've got to refer me back to the urologist. It doesn't go anywhere near 15. It tends to hover between 6.3 and 8.7, and it does go up and down a little bit, actually. But I think there's a danger that we just laugh this thing off. We have a toilet problem, getting old now, It can be old age, but it can also be something serious. You don't know unless you go through the process. So I thoroughly recommend to anybody, men, males, that if the opportunity comes along to take a PSA test, take it.
Thank you, Graham. So if you're a man, ring up the Resource Centre for a test, or contact your doctor if you have any concerns. I have to get up during the night myself to go to the toilet, often more than once. When I come back to bed, I might listen to the radio for a little bit. One Sunday morning, I listened to In Touch with Peter White, a programme for visually impaired people. It's repeated on Sunday mornings, about 5:45 or something, but it's on Tuesday nights, about 8:40, I believe. And there was a talk about the Macular Society on In Touch, referring to the fact that regional managers were being sacked, and this was affecting members' voting rights. People were getting worked up about it. Then I sort of went to sleep, and then there was a discussion about Aberdeen Angus cows on Farming Today. So do you have any idea what the argument was about with the National Macular Society, not the local Coventry branch, which is a lovely, friendly and helpful group? And Robert Franklin, he phones me up on my mobile phone on 077-318-57673 and tells me about the inspiring things he's been doing in life. And following his interview on R&IB Connect Radio, and by now he will have been interviewed on Rugby Hospital Radio about things like going on holiday by himself down to Devon by train with the help of Journeycare, etc. And he's going to be interviewed on Dawlish and Tynmouth Radio as well, Hospital Radio as well. Brilliant. Thank you to Doreen Hilton for phoning me on my home phone on 024-7659-8484 with a view to recording a message. Unfortunately, I had the tummy ache when I was speaking to her, and she kindly offered to ring back the week after. Look forward to that. As I mentioned before, this year is the 50th anniversary of Outlook on the 16th of September. Any ideas about how we can celebrate it? It's worth celebrating. And what memories have you got of listening to Outlook or helping in some way? And please let me know if you listen to Outlook, including as part of the team that produce it each week, and also from the Coventry Vision Hub, who now own it. So I need to tell them about the 50th birthday of Outlook and pass on any comments relating to Outlook and to Coventry Vision Hub. Do you like names being shortened? Coventry Resource Centre the Blind used to be referred to as CRCB, and now Coventry Vision Hub almost immediately was just called the Hub, which seems a shame. Defeats the object somehow. So that's all I've got for you in postbag. I don't know how I can encourage you to send in messages, so I'll leave it up to you. Thank you very much for your messages this week. Please, let's hear from you next time. I really can't do it without you. Okay, so keep postbag going, please. It's really, really important. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
And that's all we have from Postbag for this week. Keep your contributions coming. This week, down Warwickshire Way, we venture to the parish of Quinton, with its twin villages of Upper and Lower Quinton, 6 miles south of Stratford. A picturesque spot on the heart of England Way, it's also notorious for the 1945 Meon Hill murder of Charles Walton, a crime linked to witchcraft.
Quinton, originally Queen's Town, but spelt Q-U-E-A-N-S, in Saxon language, the word queen meant woman. So Quinton was so called because it was in possession of the nuns of Polesworth until the Norman Conquest, when King William granted their rights to Sir Robert Marmion and his heirs. In 1919, the inhabitants of Quinton, numbering about 300, were employed either on farms or in nearby market gardens. The population had grown to nearly 2,500 by 1990, many working in the nearby Royal Engineers Camp. But with the closure of the camp, the number had dropped to around 1,500, with a further 100 living in the Adminton. When the camp was closed in 1998, the army accommodation both inside and outside the camp area was vacated. The closure not only affected many local people who worked there, but also St Swithin's Church. Army personnel had carried out much work in the church, including constructing a door between the bell tower and nave, erecting a board listing previous incumbents, and making the iron light fittings. St Swithin's Church is almost 1,000 years old, and it is well worth a visit for its many different styles and periods of architecture, its heraldic windows and fascinating history. The most recent addition being a stained glass window in the chancel, incorporating the RE badge, a gift of the army and a reminder of their close involvement for many years. On a tablet on the front of the old church school is inscribed a text from Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth. The building, which was used by a youth club for several years, has a unique exterior which it is hoped will be retained when it is sold for redevelopment. The new school, built after Second World War, is still operational, and Quinton retains its village shops and post office, along with two pubs, the Gay Dog, which used to be a farmhouse, and the College Arms, originally owned by Magdalen College, Oxford, and the only pub entitled to carry the college coat of arms. Magdalen College, the major landowner, has sold off most of the larger houses and cottages. Many of the latter have been joined to make larger dwellings, as is the fashion. This applies especially to Adminton, which remains largely unspoilt. Adminton Hall is still privately owned, but Quinton House was sold about 50 years ago and is now a nursing home.
First up this week, the Word Game Dictionary Corner, compiled by lexicographer Susie Dent, which has reached episode number 27.
cat's eye. Over the past 500 years, the term cat's eye has described a precious stone with a distinctive luster, a variety of forget-me-not, and of course the eye of a cat. But it's as the name of the light-reflecting studs on our roads that cat's eyes are best known today. The inspiration for them is said to have come on a foggy night in 1933, when Percy Shaw was driving home from his local pub in West Yorkshire, and the lack of visible marks on the road made driving feel hazardous. It was then that Shaw spotted two points of lights reflected in his car's headlights, the eyes of a cat sitting on a fence near the road. Shaw patented the design for a reflective device on the road the following year. There is a word for the kind of illumination that Shaw saw. The French chatoyer means to shine like a cat's eye, while chatoyant means shimmering brightly. Anatomical snuff box. The names for parts of the human anatomy can seem fairly soulless to any layperson. Perhaps that is why in the past other names were created, to add some warmth and colour. The slight hollow overlying the lower part of the breastbone, for example, was known in medieval times rather beautifully as the heart spoon. And the small indentations in our lower back, situated just above the buttocks, are still to this day referred to as the dimples of Venus, inspired by the Roman goddess of love and beauty. But surely the most curious name belongs to radial fossa of the hand, the triangular depression on the back of the hand, just below the thumb. In the past, those partial to taking snuff as a stimulant would place the powder in this small groove before inhaling it. They consequently called it the anatomical snuff box. Cut to the quick. In Old English, the word quicku means living or alive. In the Book of Common Prayer, the phrase the quick and the dead is used to mean the living and the dead, who will both be judged on Judgment Day. This same sense of living can be found in the word quicksand, which quivers and sucks things up as though it were alive. Similarly, quicksilver is an older term for the metal mercury because it behaves as fast and unpredictably as a living thing. The sense of speed implied in today's use of quick comes from the idea of being lively and vigorous, and therefore speedy. Finally, one of the most sensitive and nerve-rich parts of the body, the tender flesh below the growing parts of our fingernails, is also known as the quick because it feels particularly alive to pain. And when we are cut to the quick, we are, by extension, cut to the core. In the pink. It's often assumed that the fruit we call an orange was named for its colour, but it is the other way round. The sweet fruit began its route into English as the Arabic naranj and was introduced into Europe in the Middle Ages. It took another century for its English name to extend to the colour of the fruit, when it replaced the cumbersome gulurid yellow-red. Similarly, the use of pink as a colour was inspired by the sweet-smelling flower of the same name, not the other way round. Pink may be a borrowing from the Dutch name from the plant, pink ogen, meaning small eyes. Since the flowers have small dots resembling eyes, it wasn't until 100 years later, in the late 1660s, that the use of pink as a colour emerged. The word also took on the meaning of beauty and perfection, so that in the pink came to mean in excellent condition, helped along by the image of rosy-cheeked health.
Long live Mary Poppins! The magic of the Disney masterpiece continues to beguile today's audiences. Francesca Steele of the I magazine explores its enduring appeal. This is read by Sue.
For more than 60 years, audiences have been revelling in A Spoonful of Sugar, Dancing Penguins and Dick Van Dyke's highly questionable Cockney accent in the joyful classic Mary Poppins. But while the film may have gone on to become one of the most beloved family films of all time, its origin story is far from supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. In fact, production on the 1964 classic was so riddled with issues, not least the fact that the author of the books on which the film was based hated the casting of Van Dyke as Chimney Sweep Bert. It's amazing the film got made at all. The popular story about a magical nanny who arrives in the early 1900s London to entertain young Jane and Michael Banks and remind their parents of the things that make life worth living, started life as a series of books written by Australian writer P.L. Travers, in which the titular nanny was stricter and dowdier than the Julie Andrews incarnation, though no less magical. Walt Disney, the filmmaker who had achieved legendary status since the release of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs in 1937, had become interested in the books because his two daughters were obsessed with them. But Travers had declined to sell the rights twice because she, correctly as it turned out, assumed Disney would make his version more sentimental. In 1959, Travers finally relented, although her distrust over certain issues, particularly casting and the use of animation, would continue. Her friend, the writer Brian Sibley, told ABC's 2020 news show that she could be an old dragon, very intimidating. Van Dyke, who turned 100 recently, once said, "Travers hated me. The author didn't think I was right, didn't think Julie was right. She wanted all of the animation taken out." Bert wasn't actually in Travers's books. He was a character added by Disney. Van Dyke also played the villainous bank boss Mr. Dawes Sr. with the aid of lots of prosthetics. But Travers had strong views nonetheless. Of course, it didn't help that Van Dyke, who had become a household name in the early 60s on the sitcom The Dick Van Dyke Show, was an alcoholic at the time. "I'd go to work with terrible hangovers," he would later recall, "which, if you're dancing, is really hard." He got sober in the 70s. Also struggling during production was his co-star Julie Andrews, making her film debut after stage success and trying to juggle the unfamiliar demands of Hollywood with a new baby. Her first child, Emma, had been born the year before. Andrews had turned down the role due to her pregnancy, but Disney was so sure she was right that he halted production until she was ready. "I'd just given birth to my daughter," Andrews said in 2013, "and the following morning my phone rang in the hospital and the voice said, 'Hello?' I said, 'Who is this?' She says, 'P.L. Travers.' I almost sat up in bed. I said, 'Oh, Miss Travers, how sweet of you to call.' She said, 'Yes, well, I understand you're going to be playing the part of Mary Poppins.' I said, 'Yes, as I understand it.' And she said, 'Well, talk to me.' I said, 'Well, I'm feeling a bit woozy right now. I just had a baby yesterday.' 'Well,' Travers said, 'you're far too pretty, of course, but you've got the nose for it.'" Andrews had had enormous success on Broadway in Camelot and London's West End in My Fair Lady, but had no experience at all on screen. Disney was also a bit of an amateur in that he'd only worked on animation, and success in live action was far from guaranteed. Although the film would go on to win an Oscar for visual effects, the new techniques were risky, and Andrews nearly died filming the iconic scene where Poppins flies using an umbrella. There was a very dangerous day right at the end of filming when I was in this excruciatingly painful harness, Andrews told The Late Show with Stephen Colbert in 2017. And I was hanging around up there for the longest time with the umbrella. I thought I felt the wire leave and drop about 6 inches. I was very nervous and very tired. She asked to be lowered gently, but her fears were realised and she fell. I plummeted to the stage and there was an awful silence for a minute, and I did let fly with a few Anglo-Saxon four-letter words, I have to admit. Travers wanted the animation taken out, but Disney was insistent. The special effects were achieved using, at the time, revolutionary techniques, including the sodium vapour process, a sort of old-fashioned green screen where actors were filmed in front of a white screen lit with the same sort of yellow seen in street lamps. Van Dyck loved being part of the visual effects process so much that he later became quite an aficionado. When I wasn't filming, I was hanging out with the animators, he later said. I spent a lot of time working with cartoon characters, which is what gave me the appetite for effects in the beginning. Looking at Mary Poppins today, it's amazing how well the technology does hold up, and that was way before computers. Travers did not feel the same. After the premiere, during which she cried, not happy tears, according to her biographer Valerie Lawson, she approached Disney thinking there was time to alter the film before public release. The first thing that has to go is that animation sequence, she said. But Disney simply replied, Pamela, that ship has sailed. There were other difficulties too. The actors playing the children hated each other. Karen Dutrice, who played Jane, aged 9, loathed Matthew Garber, then 7, who played her brother Michael. He was a real ounce of trouble and a half, she said in 2024. It's terrible because I wish I had a bunch of nice things to say about him, but we were kids and I couldn't stand him and he couldn't stand me. Dutrice had fonder memories of other co-stars. In a piece for Variety, she wrote, Dick Van Dyke would do all these goofy dances. And Julie Andrews, everybody smoked back then. I have memories of Mary Poppins smoking a cigarette. Despite all those difficulties and Travers's misgivings, when the film was finally released in August 1964, it was an instant hit. The review in the Hollywood Reporter at the time read, Walt Disney's Mary Poppins is the kind of film that creates not fans, but evangelists. Single-handedly, it might well make repeat movie-going a national habit. The question is not, have you seen Mary Poppins? The question will be, how often have you seen Mary Poppins? Quite. And the answer, for me at least, is dozens. As a viewer, I think you can feel, even today, the novelty the cast and crew felt in 1963. Disney's delight in the animations and the freedom of the newer technology. Andrews's rookie energy and enthusiasm. Even Van Dyck's bad accent has a certain charm to it. It's interesting to compare Mary Poppins with Bedknobs and Broomsticks of 1971, that other Disney mishmash of live action and animation. The rights were bought in the 60s, but development stalled for years because it was so similar to Mary Poppins. But it feels somehow more manufactured and less spontaneous. Whatever the issues with the book's author, co-star fallouts and stunt disasters, for many fans, the film remains to this day practically perfect in every way.
Coventry landmarks we've loved and lost. Well, there have been quite a few. This city is a place with a surprisingly short memory, as this article from the Coventry Telegraph shows. It's read by Elaine.
Coventry's landscape is in a constant state of flux. I'm sure we'll all agree. Buildings are being raised to make room for towering skyscrapers. Beloved artwork is vanishing, replaced by contemporary masterpieces. To reminisce about the Coventry many of us recall, we're taking a nostalgic look back at some of the city's most iconic buildings and issues that have now become part of history. The Hippodrome. Nearly two decades ago, the Hippodrome was demolished to pave the way for Millennium Place, which aimed to create a 21st century meeting place for the city. Once known as the New Hippodrome, this Art Deco-style building opened its doors in 1937. Big names such as George Formby and Gracie Fields were among those who wished the theatre a bright future at its grand opening. The New Hippodrome took the place of the neighbouring Old Hippodrome, which had opened in 1906 and was later torn down. In turn, it had replaced an even older Hippodrome, which first opened for business as far back as 1884. The city walls. The ambitious project to encircle the town began in 1355 and took a staggering 180 years to complete. It was spurred on by fears of threats from criminal gangs in the countryside seeking wealthy targets in towns. The city's walls stood for centuries before they came under attack in 1642, thanks to Charles I. During the Civil War, the city's defences, a symbol of economic power, were targeted by cannons in an attempt to use the city as a military base. The walls did their job and protected the city, so Charles I had to set up his military base elsewhere. The walls were destroyed later on in the century on the orders of his successor Charles II, concerned that at a fortified city, Coventry may become a law unto itself. Today, only the Cook Street Gate, Swanswell Gate, and small sections of wall are left. Recently, a section of wall was uncovered in the Cox Street car park as work on Coventry's tallest building got underway. The Time Zone Clock. Once housed outside the Transport Museum in Millennium Place, the Time Zone Clock was removed in 2012 for repairs. In 2015, the council confirmed that it would not be put back in place. It was initially removed so public events could be held in the area after a large screen was installed at the Transport Museum for the London 2012 Olympics. The raised nature of the clock caused the council headaches with potential injury claims and increased insurance costs for events. Councillor Rachel Lancaster previously said she would like the clock to instead to be put on the back of Primark facing Ironmonger Square. Highfield Road. Set in the heart of the city in the Hillfields area, the Sky Blues began playing at the ground in the tail end of the 19th century in 1899. Off the pitch, the ground had an interesting history. When Coventry was one of the main targets of the Luftwaffe during the Second World War, the main stand was bombed in 1940. Following the bombing, turnstiles from the ground were discovered in Gosford Park, 500 metres away. In 1968, the main stand was destroyed by fire, and its replacement was constructed within 4 months. Highfield Road was transformed into England's first ever all-seater stadium in 1981, boasting a capacity of approximately 24,500. The last match at Highfield Road took place on the 30th of April 2005 against Derby County, with the Sky Blues triumphing in a 6-2 victory. The Church of Greyfriars Monastery. The Grey Friars, also known as Franciscans, established themselves in Coventry in 1231, near Child's Moor Manor in a wooden church. Just over a century later, they quarried stone from the grounds of Child's Moor Manor and built their church in stone. However, when King Henry VIII ascended to the throne, they fell out of royal favour. As part of his church reforms, which included closing the nation's monasteries, he forced them to leave. Their church was demolished on the orders of King Henry VIII, but the spire preserved. In October 1829, construction work began on a new church, Christ Church, to encircle the spire. A Second World War bombing raid destroyed Christ Church, but once again the spire survives and stands in New Union Street, Coventry City Centre. The King's Head Hotel. The King's Head Hotel was inaugurated in 1879, located at the junction of Hertford Street and Smithford Street. Historically, it's believed that an inn has occupied the site since the Middle Ages, eventually replaced by the King's Head Inn in the 19th century, which welcomed many illustrious guests, including Lord Nelson. Upon the hotel's opening, it also housed Dunn's Outfitters. As a result, the junction of Hertford Street and Smithford Street became known as Dunn's Corner. Regrettably, it was among the numerous buildings obliterated in the Coventry 1940 Blitz.
For the latest in their seemingly endless search for fun people and places, Dave and Graham Monks head for the bright lights of Liverpool and Port Sunlight.
Hello there, Graham and I are in Liverpool. Now, we have just walked past some blocked off streets and they're making a film, apparently.
Yeah, apparently it's Clayface, which is their spin-off of Batman, apparently.
That's it. So they're making part of Liverpool to look like Gotham City. And why have you come to Liverpool in particular? Why have we come?
we're getting to Port Sunlight tomorrow.
Yes.
For the Magic Mondays afternoon, yeah.
Magic Monday's afternoon. Fantastic. There's a big party atmosphere there. And we are right outside Molly Malone's. And there's a singer there you've been friends of for quite some time via Facebook.
Yeah, Cathy Carter, yeah. Sort of Irish descent, I think, yeah.
Speaking to Cathy, a singer that Graham follows, in a pub called Molly Malone's, an Irish bar. Wow. So there you are. So can you tell me about, firstly, you've been to singing in Las Vegas. That impresses us, doesn't it?
I know. It was the Celtic Convention. So it's a week-long convention where ex-players for Celtic come over. Speakers, you get like a dinner dance, and then there's, after the main event, there's a bar in the main foyer, and that's where I was playing from 12 till 2 or 12 till 3 in the morning every night for like 5 nights. Yeah. And we had a pool party as well, but it was in a hotel called the Westgate Resort, but originally it was the Hilton, and that's where Elvis Presley was resident in, and his penthouse is still, they said to me, you can't go up there, but they said his penthouse is still in the same way it was when he died, his penthouse up there, yeah. So it was unbelievable, yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm speaking to a Facebook friend of Graham's.
Molly Malone's is great because, yeah, great atmosphere, no problem. We're seeing Cathy Carter tonight, doing some Irish songs, and it's just fabulous, and it's really recommended.
Liverpool is a great musical city. When you walk down the street, there's music coming from virtually every bar. In one pub, we listened and danced to Soul Jam, a fabulous trio, two men that looked like characters from Peaky Blinders with flat caps and waistcoats, and Jo, she was the female singer whom I spoke to.
Hey! lovely to meet you. Is it Coventry?
Yeah, it is.
Hello, Coventry. I've been here once. I think I must come back for a visit soon.
You must do. We've just come out of Tess O'Reilly's and we've been entertained by Soul Jam. Well, we've had a fantastic night out in Liverpool, haven't we, Graham?
Yeah,
great stuff, dancing. Do you reckon that's what they call Northern Soul? Soul Jam?
That sort of thing went on in the Northern Soul days, yeah.
It did, yeah. Well, it's been great anyway. Hello, I'm speaking down Matthew Street, just next to the Cilla Black statue, and this young lady's just taken a picture of me and Graham. What's your name?
My name is Tamra, and nice to meet you all. I'm from Liverpool, I live in Formby, and it's such a blessing to meet this gorgeous man, and I hope he has an amazing night.
Thank you. Is the cavern one of your favourite haunts, Matthew Street?
Well, I'm not actually been myself, but I love it here in Eric's, it's really good. Yeah, I love it.
We've arrived in the lovely village of Port Sunlight. So what are we doing here, Graham?
The Magical Moments afternoon, yeah.
Fantastic, and that's in the Lever Hall, is it?
Lever Club, yeah.
The Lever Club, fantastic. So what do we know about Port Sunlight, Graham?
It's founded by the Lever Brothers.
Yeah, okay. And they founded the Sunlight Soap Factory. And then this beautiful village was built for the workers. Oh, we've just come into the Lever Club now.
Welcome home! Welcome! Come on in and close the door.
Those ladies singing are the ladies that take the money as you come in through the door of the Levers Club. Tracy, we're in the Levers Club at the moment, and you're in charge of all this kind of organised chaos party atmosphere.
Absolutely. We absolutely love it. Every single Monday, everybody comes. It's busy, full of friendliness, everyone's welcoming, very kind, and people love it. They're never on their own when you come into one of our events. You're never on your own.
Now, I'm speaking to Sheila right now, so you're a regular here, then.
I come when I can, yes. Yeah. Not everyone, but yes, so it's really good. It's nice to meet new people, have a dance, relax, and just enjoy the afternoon.
What's your name, please?
Dave Campbell.
Dave Campbell. So
yeah.
Okay, you love it here, then.
Oh, we love it, yeah. We teach them all how to dance.
By the Beatles. Well, Graham and I are walking along the prom in Southport now, and we can see the sea, can't we? It's not too far out.
Not too far out, I think. You can see Blackpool Tower and the big one.
That's the Big Dipper. Right, in the fun fair. Okay, thank you very much. Well, it's all from our lovely holiday. Thank you very much again, Graham. Fantastic. You enjoy it?
Yeah, good.
Yeah, all the dancing, all the music, fantastic. Okay, so it's bye from Southport and our holidays. Bye.
Bye.
That almost brings us to the end of this week's programme, so it's farewell from the Outlook team and from me, Peter Walters.